Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me. It's a privilege to be here with you this Sunday morning. A couple of comments first about why this type of topic is important, why I'm here to be the one presenting it. Rob touched on this briefly, but I'm here as a former atheist and evolutionist. I'm now neither of those things. I was an atheist because I was an evolutionist, and this was well into my adult years. And it wasn't until my time in military space program that that changed. I was confronted with evidence against my atheism and evolutionism and tried to disprove it. And after almost a year of digging into that subject, came to the conclusion that my atheism and evolutionism were false. Creationism had to be true. I didn't want it to be true. So that was a struggle for a while, but eventually I came to accept it. And then that opened the door to me becoming a Christian later. And I like to open some of my talks by mentioning this because, as Rob mentioned, a lot of times the other side in this debate says that we have these blinders on of faith, that we have this faith in the Bible as being true and God's Word. I didn't touch anything. Okay. And the other side tells us that if we could take off these blinders of faith, then we could see science objectively, and then we would see all the evidence for the millions of years and neo-Darwinian processes and so on. And I'm one of many for whom the opposite is true. I became convinced by the evidence first that creation was true, and then that opened the door to me becoming a Christian. And I also think it's important to mention creationism is not sufficient to make one a Christian, right? I mean, because that's the work of the Holy Spirit. There are Muslims who are creationists. But there are still many who are in the category that I used to be, that science is their stumbling block. And so since coming to the Lord, this has been my passion to share this information with people. And in giving a creation talk, there's lots of different things we could talk about. We could talk about genetics. I mean, there's evidence in our genes, in our DNA, that we are all descended from one man and one woman, all of us in the entire world. We could talk about evidence that dinosaurs lived thousands of years ago, not millions. We could talk about evidence for a global flood, as Genesis talks about. And those are common topics in these talks. Rather than challenging the standard evolutionary model, though, there's a question that we are often asked, and that is, if the biblical account of creation is true, and the earth is young, that implies that the universe is young, too, how then do we explain the fact that we can see objects that are so far away, it would seem to take their light a long time to get here? Because, indeed, all these objects are emitting light, apparently, and it travels through space to get here. Most of these objects, the light travels over vast distances. Certainly would seem to take longer than 6,000 years to get here. Yet, nevertheless, it has arrived here somehow. We are able to see all of these things. So if the biblical account of creation is true, how is this possible? So this is my subject here this morning. Now, to do this, I asked the question, how do you know how long it takes something to travel from one place to another anyway? Well, we do this sort of reasoning in our lives all the time. Like, if I need to drive 200 kilometers, and I'm going to drive 100 kilometers per hour, how much time would it take me to do that? This 2 hours, right? How do you reach that conclusion? How do you make that calculation? Well, without probably even realizing it, you're using a simple equation. The time equals the distance divided by the speed. And this is the same equation that is used to tell us that the light would need a long time to get here from way out there. So we're going to talk about this equation a little bit. And for those who are math phobic, I apologize, but this is the only equation we'll be doing. So hopefully it's not too bad. What do we use as the speed when we're talking about this particular subject? Well, the objects that we're dealing with in space are light years, for the most part, away. And a light year is the distance light can travel in 1 year. So despite the word year being in this word, it's actually a measure of distance, not of speed. So not of time. So we see all these objects in space. Not only do we need to deal with the ones that are millions and billions of light years away, there's even objects that are closer to us that would still seem to raise challenges for a biblical worldview. Like the Bubble Nebula here, which is within our own Milky Way galaxy. But even within our Milky Way, this is 7 to 11,000 light years away. So longer for the light to get here, apparently, than the Bible would say for the age of the Earth. So my point is, this isn't just an issue for the farthest away galaxies. Even things within our Milky Way raise this question. So this seems like a simple calculation. If the time equals the distance over the speed, and we're looking at something like that nebula roughly 10,000 light years away, and if the speed of light is 1 light year per year, then it would seem that the light would take 10,000 years to get here. So you see there's a straightforward correspondence between the distance and the apparent time required. And not only for close-by objects, even, for example, the largest galaxy that's close to us, the Andromeda Galaxy, 2.5 million light-years away, would seem to require, therefore, 2.5 million years for the light to get here from there. Now, modern technology has provided us all sorts of wonderful opportunities. Our ground-based observatories are doing things that were never before possible in human history. For example, some of the observatories now are using lasers and adaptive optics to compensate for atmospheric turbulence. But we even have telescopes above the atmosphere, like Hubble and more recently James Webb, able to take images of things that were never before possible in human history, and therefore able to look into regions that were never before accessible to us. This picture from Hubble shows a lot of galaxies out to 13.2 billion light years away. We're seeing objects up to 13.5 billion, and actually James Webb is even pushing this a little bit further. So now we're seeing objects that would seem to take billions with a B, and that's 1,000 million. So billions of years for the time to get here. And this seems like a straightforward issue, right? I mean, it's not that hard to understand the problem that this would seem to present for the biblical worldview. In fact, the atheists love to talk about this. This Rational Wiki, an atheist version of Wikipedia, has a long page on this because they think it's a knockout blow for their side. I mean, you can sum it up in four words. We see distant stars. How can, therefore, the Bible be true? So I'm going to refer to this issue as the LTT problem, the light travel time problem, in this presentation, just as a nice convenient abbreviation. So why does all this matter anyway? I mean, does the Bible really require that the world is young? Well, by looking at genealogies, we can calculate that Adam was around roughly 6,000 years ago. And the Bible tells us that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and that very close to that beginning is when God created man in his own image. And behold, God saw everything he had made, and it was very good, and that was on the sixth day of creation. Now, sometimes people say, well, maybe those days of creation weren't really literal 24-hour days. Maybe they're long periods of time when we can fit the millions of years in there somehow. Well, the Bible doesn't actually permit that. Now, there are a lot of Christians who believe this, and this is not a salvation issue, so I'm not questioning that, but I am saying that they're being inconsistent with some of the teaching of Scripture. For example, in Mark chapter 10, the Pharisees were challenging Jesus, and they said, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of dismissal and divorce her. They were arguing about divorce. But Jesus said to them, he wrote this commandment for you because of your hard hearts, but at the beginning of creation, God made them male and female, referring to Adam and Eve. So we know from the genealogies, Adam was around roughly 6,000 years ago, and if he was made right at the beginning of creation, then that would imply the entire earth is only that old as well. And, of course, Jesus would know when all of this happened because John chapter 1 and other places tell us that Jesus is the creator. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So the creator himself tells us that Adam was made right at the beginning, which would put the earth at 6,000 years old. And since the contents of the heavens weren't around until day 4 of creation week after the earth was formed, that would tell us that the universe itself is that old as well. So all this is to say that from a superficial look at this issue, the LTT challenge would seem to be a fatal problem for the biblical creation view. But that's actually not true. Of course, I'm just going to say it's not true. That's what I'm here to speak about. Turns out, for one thing, this challenge is not a unique issue for us. By us, I mean us on the creation side of the creation-evolution debate. Turns out the evolutionists and those who believe in the billions of years have this problem as well. Why am I saying that? Well, there's something called the CMB, the Cosmic Microwave Background. This is radiation coming to Earth from all directions in space. Now, those who believe in the Big Bang will tell you this is the afterglow of the Big Bang. I don't believe in the Big Bang model. There's lots of problems with it. Setting those aside, though, the Big Bang model says that at the time this alleged afterglow was made, light had not yet had enough time to travel across the entire universe. In fact, it can only have traveled in a very small distances across the universe. Therefore, the Big Bang model predicts that there would be variations in temperature throughout this radiation that the Big Bang supposedly produced. But that's not true. The entire universe is actually almost exactly the same temperature, down to 1/1000th of a degree. So this is known as the horizon problem. You can look this up on Wikipedia if you're curious. clearly, light has traveled across the entire universe at the time this radiation was produced, but the Big Bang model says there had not been enough time yet for it to have done so. Now, Big Bang believers are aware of this problem. They try to solve it with something called cosmic inflation that has a whole host of other problems that I won't take the time to get into. My point right now is that the Big Bang model has an LTT problem of its own. So if a secular person points a finger at you and says, well, how do you deal with light travel time? You can point the finger right back and say, this is an issue for everybody, not just those on the creation side. Furthermore, we aren't on the defensive here anyway because there are multiple possible solutions to this from our perspective. So that will be my time here this morning talking about these. Because it turns out there's actually 7 assumptions built into this question. Some of them are so subtle you wouldn't even realize they were there. And it turns out that all 7 of these assumptions must be true for this to be a valid challenge. If all 7 are not true, even if only 1 is not true, the challenge is invalidated. And it turns out at least one of them is certainly false, and the rest can be questioned. So what do I mean by assumptions? Well, back to our equation here, time equals distance over speed. Seems like a straightforward calculation, right? Well, think about the speed here. This equation assumes that the speed is constant throughout the entire time that the light has traveled. So here's an idea. Maybe the speed of light has decreased through time. And some of you might have heard this because this idea has been around for a while. If that were the case, then light would have needed less time to travel here than you would otherwise calculate based on today's measured speed. And this is, of course, a crucial assumption in this question. Now, I will say this is apparently a valid assumption. There was a lot of interest in this idea within the creation community for a while. After further investigation, it didn't really withstand scrutiny. So most of them in the creation community today would tell you that the speed of light apparently has been constant throughout history, as best as we can tell. So does that mean that this whole challenge is a problem for us? No, because this is only the first of 7 assumptions. And most of the rest have problems, as we will see. So back to our equation. Not only does this equation assume that the speed of light has been constant, it assumes that we know what the speed of light is. You might say, well, of course we know what the speed of light is. You can look it up in a textbook or Wikipedia or whatever. Well, when you look it up somewhere, you'll be told the two-way speed of light, the speed of light when it travels out somewhere and comes back, like if you bounce it off a mirror. Turns out the only way we can measure the speed of light is in 2 directions at once. You have to fire it from one place, bounce it off a mirror or something, and come back to you in order to time it correctly. And if anybody wants details about that, you can ask me during Q&A. But this equation is not based on the two-way speed of light. We're talking about light that started there and traveled here and only traveled in one direction. And it turns out we don't know what the one-way speed of light is. This is a famous problem in physics. It's not merely a matter of we don't have good enough technology to measure it. It's physically impossible to know what this number is, as this page admits and as you could learn more online if you're curious about that. So if we don't know what the one-way speed of light is, then we can't do this calculation because that number is not only unknown, it's unknowable. It also turns out that when you're doing this kind of calculation, you can actually pick different one-way numbers for the speed of light as long as your calculation has the known two-way speed of light when you're done calculating. And I realize that that's kind of an opaque statement. But my point is the one-way speed of light is a convention that is chosen, and you can choose different values depending on the system you're working with. That means that there's no absolute one-way speed of light, so it's both unknowable and not absolute, which means you can't do this calculation at all. So for the 7 assumptions, we saw the first one apparently is valid, but the second one is that the one-way speed of light is absolute, and we know it. This is false. We don't know what the one-way speed of light is. It's unknowable, even in principle, and it's also not absolute. So we could actually stop this conversation right here because this calculation relies on something that is unavailable. We don't have the one-way speed of light to work with. Nevertheless, though, let's proceed and see what else we can glean from this equation. What about challenging the distance? Well, sometimes people wonder, is it true that maybe that these things are really so far away? Maybe that's not the case. Well, there is some uncertainty in the distances, but up to the millions and billions of light years away, that uncertainty does not collapse down to thousands of light years, certainly. So, yes, these things are vast distances away. However, that doesn't necessarily mean the light had to travel that far. What if the light beams were created in place? That when the Lord created the universe, he not only made the stars and the earth, he also made light beams connecting us to those stars. After all, if the heavens are to declare the glory of God, shouldn't they do so right away? I mean, shouldn't Adam be able to perceive the stars right away? So this view is called mature creation. Sometimes people call it the appearance of age, but that's not really a good description. Adherents of this idea prefer to call it mature creation, that the Lord just created a mature cosmos, including complete beams of light already in place. Now, people who advocate this point out that mature creation certainly is necessary for part of the creation. I mean, when Adam woke up in the Garden of Eden, did he wake up next to a pile of seeds and pits that he had to plant and wait years for trees to grow? Well, no. I mean, he grew up next to mature plants, mature fruit trees and whatever, things that would seem to need to take several years to grow. But no, Adam was created within a functional, mature earth. So if that's the case for the earth, why not the cosmos too? Now, there are those who don't like this idea. And I'm discussing pros and cons of these ideas, by the way, in this presentation. So even within the creation community, there are people who don't like this. And they say, well, there's a problem with this in that this would make God deceptive. What do they mean by that? Well, we see things that are far away that appear to be events, not merely stars, but things that change. For example, this right here, here's a close-up of it, is a supernova explosion that happened in the year 1987, thus its name 1987A. So we saw a star, and then in 1987 the star exploded. Now the star was about 168,000 light years from us. So if the mature creation view is correct, then the Lord created the earth and something out there with a light beam connecting us to it that's 168,000 light years long. Now, if the earth is only 6,000 years old, then we have only consumed, if you will, the first 6,000 light years of this light beam. So here's the earth, here's a light beam, and out here somewhere off the screen is the object that this beam is connecting us to. So for the first 6,000 years or so of history, this light has been streaming toward us. Now, the first part of it contained an image of a star for thousands of light years, right? But then, at some point in this beam, an image of the supernova replaced the image of a star. And subsequently, through time, we've watched this supernova remnant expand, and there's actually some interesting physics going on here. But people who don't like the mature creation idea point out that if this is true, then this star never actually existed. It was merely an image built into this light beam, but the other end here never actually contained a star. For that matter, the supernova explosion never happened either. It was only a series of images built into the light beam further back. And we won't actually even know, no extra charge for the Hollywood quality graphics here, by the way. We don't even know what's out here, and we won't know for another 162,000 years from now for us to actually consume all of the original light that was created. So that's an objection to the mature creation view. Now, the advocates have a counter-objection. They say, well, it wouldn't be deceptive if God told us what he did. I mean, was Adam deceived by waking up next to mature fruit trees? No, because the Lord said, hey, I made plants on day three. So these aren't 4 to 5 years old and bearing fruit now. They're only a few days old. In similar fashion, if the Lord told us he made the heavens and the earth, then that's what he did. We're not deceived because he's telling us. There's another issue with this, too, that the advocates point out. Everybody agrees that the earth, at least, had to be created mature. What about the stars? I mean, that's really what all the contention is about. If you think about this, at least one star had to be created mature. Because if our understanding of solar physics is correct, the sunlight we are receiving today wasn't made by the sun. So the sun produces light by nuclear fusion deep inside of its core. That light is immediately reabsorbed by other material there, and then emitted, reabsorbed. It takes thousands of years, 10,000 years or more, for sunlight to work its way out from the core to the surface. Now, once it reaches the surface, it streams dust at the speed of light through space in 8 minutes and 20-some-odd seconds. But it took thousands of years to get there. Therefore, if Adam could see the sun when he woke up, that light his eyes were receiving was not made by the sun. It was made by the Lord as part of this mature creation. And in fact, this would still be continuing on today. So my point is the earth had to be created mature, and at least one star, our sun, had to be created mature as well, in as much as there's a beam of light created in place for us to consume. So why not the other stars as well? Now, I'm not taking a position on this issue this morning. I actually forgot to mention this. I generally try to avoid taking any position on this. I have my own views as to which of these solutions is best. But my point in this morning is presenting the variety of solutions that people within the creation community are discussing, so you can draw your own conclusions on this. So that was the third assumption in this challenge, that the universe was not created mature. What would the fourth assumption be? Well, let's go back to our equation, and let's talk about the distance again. Excuse me. Genesis 1 says something interesting. Genesis 1, verses 11 and 12. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb-yielding seed, and the fruit tree. And the earth brought forth grass, and herb-yielding seed after its kind, and the tree. If you don't read this closely, you might think of the creation of plants as the Lord said, let there be plants, and boom, lo, there was plants. That's not what it says, right? Lord said, let the earth bring forth plants, and that's what happened. A number of years ago, a Bible-believing astronomer named Dr. Danny Faulkner was reading this and noticed this and said, well, this is interesting. So the Hebrew word here for bringing forth is dasha. And he said, well, if the plants just came forth out of the earth all on the third day, then it sounds like they grew like plants normally do from seeds and such, but it just happened in a very short period of time, like it was an accelerated process. Well, if the Lord accelerated plant growth on day three, what if he accelerated starlight travel on day four? So what if the stars emitted light like they normally would, and the Lord just supernaturally accelerated everything on its way to us? And that's how we can perceive it all today. Notice that this does not have the deception issue, because the star we saw that blew up in that supernova actually existed, and the supernova actually happened, etc. It's just that the light has reached us here in a very short period of time because the Lord made it do that. Now, some people don't care for this explanation because it's explicitly miraculous, and they'd say, well, how is a credentialed PhD scientist endorsing a miraculous explanation? Well, yes, it is a miraculous explanation, but so is the universe. I mean, creation was a miraculous time, right? You look far back enough into history, you're going to run out of laws of physics sooner or later. You can't account for the events in the early parts of Genesis using just laws of physics. Furthermore, we shouldn't even be ashamed of this as Christians, because it turns out everybody on both sides of the creation-evolution debate has to endorse miracles when it comes to the universe. And normally at this point in the presentation, I would continue talking, but because we're doing a little bit different format this morning, I'm going to set aside the distant starlight issue for a few minutes and focus on the miraculous aspect of the universe. Hope everyone doesn't mind me doing that. But normally I would say this for Q&A, but I think it's good to have it here because this is a good topic to end with just as we go to the break. This will bring us right up to that. So, let's talk about the universe for a moment, rather than just light travel time. Let's focus on the beginning of the universe. And we'll ask a simple question, just six words. Did the universe have a beginning? How many possible answers are there to this question? There's two, right? Yes or no? I mean, that's clear, right? Either yes, there was a beginning, or no, there was not a beginning, which would mean the universe would be eternal. It's always been there if it never began. If it exists and it never began, therefore, it must be eternal. This is what I call the secular dilemma. Secular meaning you're trying to answer this question without God. You're trying to build a model for why the universe is here without God. And dilemma refers to a choice between equally unfavorable alternatives. You have to make a choice, but you don't want to choose any of the options because all the options are bad. So it turns out this question reveals that even secular scientists have to believe in miracles to explain the universe. What do I mean by that? Well, To answer the question, did the universe have a beginning, we just agreed that there's only two possible answers. Both of these answers violate the laws of physics in different ways. And if you're a secular modeler who's trying to explain where the universe came from or why it's there, you have to pick one of the two answers, so you're going to violate physics in your model one way or the other. And if you violate physics, then that is kind of the definition of a miracle, right? If you're doing something that the laws of physics don't allow. So let's explore this. What if you try to say, yes, the universe had a beginning? Again, we're thinking like secular scientists here who don't want to accept that God is responsible for it all. Well, if the universe had a beginning, and if the universe is everything, which is what the word means, then everything had a beginning. So if everything had a beginning, what existed before that beginning? Nothing, right? Because if something existed before the beginning, then whatever it was that began wasn't the universe, right? Okay, so if everything had a beginning, then before the universe, before the beginning, there was nothing. And of course, the Big Bang model says that there was a beginning to the universe, right? So the Big Bang model falls into this category. So I actually have a picture here of what the universe looked like before the Big Bang. Like that. Because that's nothing. Of course, that's just an artist's conception, so I took some liberties. But can you go from nothing to everything? Can you go from nothing to anything? Can nothing make everything? No. Nothing can create nothing, right? Because nothing can do nothing. From nothing comes nothing. Dr. R.C. Sproul once said, if there were ever once truly nothing, there could never be anything. And Dr. Phil Fernandez once said, you can't tell me nothing made everything. I know too much about nothing. Now, so far, that sounds like a philosophical argument, but there's actually a law of physics that formalizes this. It used to be known as the first law of thermodynamics, but now, as Rob pointed out earlier, it has a new name now. It's now called the conservation of mass energy. Let's talk about this for a moment. So this law of physics says that matter and energy are conserved. The total combined amount of these two never changes. Now, you can change the relative amounts, but when one goes up, the other has to go down to compensate so that their total is fixed, unchanging. What do I mean by change relative amounts? Well, physics now understands that there's an equivalence between matter and energy. You may have heard the famous equation E equals mc squared. So E is energy, m is the amount of mass, the amount of physical stuff you have, and c is the speed of light, which we've already mentioned is a large number. So if you remember your algebra, that means a little bit of stuff contains a lot of energy. So we can convert them back and forth. So how do you convert matter to energy? Well, the most efficient way we know how to do that is a nuclear explosion. A little bit of stuff converts into a lot of energy, right? We can go the opposite direction and take a lot of energy and convert it into a little bit of stuff. And we do that in particle accelerators. Little chunks of matter get zipping around and close to the speed of light, smash them together. More stuff comes out of the collisions than went in. Not just the number of particles, but the amount of matter, the amount of physical stuff. But are we making this stuff from nothing? No, we're converting the kinetic energy, the energy of motion, into physical matter. So my point is we can convert matter to energy, we can convert energy to matter, but you can't make either one from nothing because that violates this law of physics. So physics says you can't get something from nothing. You have to start with something in order to have something afterward. And we see this principle in our lives every day. I mean, if you think about this, why do we need to eat food every day? Regardless of how difficult the process might sometimes be, because your body needs energy to work, can't make it from nothing because that violates this law of physics, so you need to get it from the chemical energy stored in the food after you successfully get it in your mouth, but that's a problem outside of physics. Why do you get a bill from the power company every month? Because your appliances need energy to operate, can't make it from nothing, that violates physics, so you have to get it from the power company, which also can't get it from nothing because that violates physics. It has to get it from the chemical energy stored in coal or the gravitational potential energy in flowing water, or solar energy from the sun, which also isn't making it from nothing because that violates physics. The sun has to burn its own version of fuel to produce energy and so on. My point is this is very fundamental, not just law of physics, but it permeates our lives around us. In fact, we couldn't be having this presentation this morning if it weren't for this law, because some of the principles of circuit design in this computer are based on this law of physics. As one of my textbooks says, conservation laws are the guiding principles of physics. These are absolute conservation laws. They are always obeyed. So at the risk of belaboring the point, all of this is to say something could not have come from nothing. Now, if you follow the origins debate, you might be aware that there are some atheists that claim that something can and did come from nothing. I want to answer that here. If you are curious about it, you can bring it up in Q&A, and we'll talk about why that argument is false. For now, it should be fairly clear, though, something can't come from nothing. So the yes answer to this question, did the universe have a beginning, violates this fundamental law of physics. What about the other option? What about no? Well, now we'll talk about a different law of physics called the second law of thermodynamics. And I like to use coffee as an illustration of this. So if you walk into a room and there's a hot cup of coffee on the table, how long has the cup been there? Long time or short time? Short time, right? Why? Because it's still hot. It hasn't cooled off yet. Can it have been there forever? No. Had it been there forever, it would have cooled off forever ago, right? You can use coffee as a crude form of clock. We can do the same thing and apply the same logic to the universe. Is there anything in the universe that hasn't cooled off yet? Lots of things, right? Stars. Our sun is one of them, but stars in general. If the universe had been here forever, stars would have all burned out forever ago, but they're still there. Now, some stars won't burn out only because they blow up or have other things happen to them before they have a chance to do that. But my point is, every star has a finite lifespan. If the universe had been here forever, then they would all have been gone forever ago. Now, sometimes people say, wait a minute, new stars can form. There's actually problems with that from a secular perspective, but setting that aside, star formation still requires energy. There's a limited amount of that available. If the universe had been here forever, that energy would have been consumed forever ago. But that's not what we see. The heat energy in the universe is still very unevenly distributed. We have very hot stars in vast expanses of cold space. Billions of years from now, actually more than that, but whatever, every star will have burned out. All that heat will be evenly distributed. The entire universe will be just a couple of degrees above absolute zero. Of course, this isn't going to happen because the Lord's coming back long before that happens. But my point is, if you don't believe that, then that's what you understand will happen. Hasn't happened yet, which means the universe isn't eternally old. Sometimes Christians say that we need to accept the Big Bang model because it's consistent with Genesis and it shows the universe had a beginning. Actually, it's not consistent with Genesis. Set that aside, though. My point right now is we don't need the Big Bang model to prove the universe had a beginning. If you want to prove the universe had a beginning, walk outside and look up. Do you see the sun during the day? Do you see stars at night? If so, the universe had a beginning. And I think that's kind of fun. I mean, just walk outside and see the sun. It reminds you that the universe had a beginning and that the Lord brought it all into existence. Now, atheists have an objection to that, which I won't bother covering right now. My point here, though, we already saw the yes answer to this question is not allowed because it violates physics. Now we see that the no answer requires the universe to be eternal, which physics doesn't allow that either. What other options does the secular modeler have? There aren't any. We already agreed there's only the two choices. Both of them violate physics in different ways. So the secular modeler doesn't have the privilege of making a model that's consistent with all of physics. His only choice is which law of physics he's going to violate in his model. Now, as Christians, we have a third option. Yes, the universe had a beginning because stars haven't burned out yet, but that beginning doesn't violate physics because there's a supernatural creator outside of the universe that brought it all into existence. And a supernatural creator is the only explanation that doesn't violate physics. Because if you think about it, there's only three possibilities for the existence of the universe. Either it was formed by a creator, or it formed without a creator, or it never formed because it has always existed. And we saw forming without a creator violates one law of physics. Never forming at all and always existing violates a different law of physics. So the only logical option left is that it was formed by a creator. And to bring this back to our main topic, you see then, everyone has to believe in a miracle. We do, and the secular side does too. The difference is we know who the miracle maker is. They must believe in a miracle while denying that miracles are possible. So you see the inconsistency that they are forced to incorporate. I like working this particular subject into my talks because it's a simple question, right? Did the universe have a beginning? Yes or no, the only two answers. It's a great conversation starter. Not everyone will resonate with this, but some people will, and you can get people thinking. And I will note that this question worked on me. This is the question that led me to start challenging or questioning my own atheism. And I didn't like it. So it'll work on some people. I'd also argue, now the Bible doesn't say this, but I'd also argue that this is evidence of God's grace. The Lord could have put us in, or let me back up. The Lord could have made the universe any way he wanted to, right? He could have placed us in a universe that looks like the result of natural processes operating over long periods of time. And he could have told us, don't worry about what it looks like, trust my word, I'm responsible for all of this. He had the right to do it that way. But had he done it that way, how many of us would struggle to have faith in his word despite what our eyes seem to be telling us? So in his grace, the Lord didn't do that. He put us in a universe that looks created. The laws that show us how the universe operates tell us he's responsible for it all. And I think that's wonderful. So getting back to our main subject then, we see that although the idea of accelerated starlight is explicitly miraculous, we shouldn't be ashamed of that because everybody has to accept miracles, all sides of the origins debate. The difference is miracles are consistent with our position, inconsistent with the other side. Whether they want to admit it or not, though, they have to affirm that that's what happened. So of the seven assumptions, that is number four, that light has always traveled through space as it does today. My next topic will take a bit longer to get into. So it is 12:06, 12:07. This might be a good chance for a break then. Thank you all for your attention so far. Hopefully this last thing, ending on that, will give you something to think about and chew on. And again, great question for sharing with non-believers. Get them thinking.